Hi, I'm Scott Jones. I'm director of the Electronic Frontiers Forums at DragonCon, and this is the self-publishing panel. And so I would like to ask the panelists here to introduce themselves and tell me what you're doing, what your project is, and how self-publishing has helped you. And Jenny, you can start.
My name is Jenny Breeden. I do a webcomic that's called The Devil's
Way. Oh, I worry about talking into this thingy.
Oh, there we go.
That one's live.
Okay. I'm used to just projecting to the back, and I'm worried about blowing out their microphones. My name is Jenny Breeden. I do The Devil's Panties. It's a webcomic online and updates every day, and there's a couple people have read it. I've got three graphic novels printed, and one of them I did publish myself, but I've been printing up my own books for the past since 2001.
Hi, I'm Gail Z. Martin, and I have confession to make. I'm actually not self-published. I'm the author of the Chronicles of the Necromancer fantasy series from Solaris Books, which is now Rebellion. But I handle the marketing for my own books, and my success with marketing the series has led to doing book marketing as a subspecialty of my day job, which is running a marketing firm. And so I work with a lot of self-published authors, both on the fiction and the nonfiction side, to help them successfully market their books. And I have a new nonfiction book coming out called The Thrifty Author's Guide to Launching Your Book Without Losing Your Mind. It's not self-published either, but it does deal with both fiction and nonfiction, self-published and traditional published. So I think that's why I'm here.
I'm Scott Sigler, author of a few hard science horror novels, some of which are published by Crown Publishing, so definitely not self-published, and then also now co-founder of Dark Overlord Media, which just put out this book called The Rookie. And that is why we're here, to talk about doing both non-self-publishing and self-publishing and how those can connect.
My name's A. Kovacs. I am the other co-founder of Dark Overlord Media. I'm not a writer at all, but I'm the sort of production, logistics, project management side of what is essentially a self-published publishing house, which is Dark Overlord. So,
And I think the other piece to toss in here is that I think a lot of the things that we're going to talk about, whether it's self-publishing or small press, or even today's traditional press, you really have to act as if you're self-published, even if you're published by a big house, because nobody's going to do it for you.
Yeah. Can you hear this?
Whether you're published by a small house, a traditional large house, or you're self-published, you better act as if you're self-published, because nobody else is going to take care of your book for you.
That's even true in the comic book world. I had a friend of mine who was... Oh, let's steal this one. Okay. That's also true in the comic book world, in that I have a friend of mine who was published through Dark Horse, and so it is a big publishing firm, but they didn't do any... Like you said, you have to promote yourself. They didn't do any promotion for her, so she wasn't really selling very many books, so they didn't... Because she wasn't selling many books, they didn't promote her. And it was this cycle, and so finally she just had to do her own thing and act like a self-publisher, because no one's going to work as hard on your book as you are.
Right. And that also exists in the larger print houses too, being published by Crown, which is a division of Random House, which I've been told is the largest publisher in the world. Like, that's the big time. And even having hit the New York Times bestseller list, my last one out, I'm still going forward with the next book, Ancestor, out in May. I've got it down, sorted down to a science now. I'm doing everything. Mm-hmm. I treat my publisher as a vendor. I'm like, I need these tasks accomplished by these dates. Can you do them, yes or no? If they are not done or the money's not been spent by this date, then I will take over that. So it's the same thing.
I do the same thing with my publisher. I tell them what I'm planning to do to market the book. I ask them if that's going to trample any toes. They say no, run with it, and I do. The great thing is you get creative control of your marketing that way, and you also pay for it.
Yeah. I shot myself in the foot because I didn't do that. I thought that the publisher was a professional and knew what they were doing. I sent them my book and then figured that they would take care of everything, and I didn't stay on top of them, and I didn't say, okay, when is it coming out? What's going on with it? Where is it right now? Is it being shipped? Is it on the truck? What's going on? I just waited until I thought it was supposed to be at my doorstep, and then it didn't show up, and then it didn't show up, and then it didn't show up,
And so I called them up and they said, oh yeah, we're not printing anything anymore. You couldn't have told me that 2 months ago? So yeah, definitely staying on top of them and using the publisher as a bad phrasing here, but as a tool, as opposed to, oh, well, the publisher is, you know, will be taking care of me, as opposed to vice versa.
Well, and it's funny I'm not an author, but from my perspective, it's fascinating to see how much work went into. I mean, basically, I started out we just published this book last week, and I started out like, great, what do I know about books? They're sold at Barnes & Noble, let's go there. And I literally started like, what is the same about all of these books on this shelf, and how do I get there? And what does the copyright page look like? Oh, this number, I don't know what this number is. Let me see if I can figure that out. But then I actually went to talk to people who I know who are book like copy editors and stuff like that, and they're all like, well, I don't know. Like, what? You work for a publishing house. What do you mean you don't know? I'm like, well, I don't know. So we made a lot of it up as we went along, but like, okay, so something's missing here. What seven things could it be? Let me go see if I can figure that out. Because nobody else is doing it for you. And you're right, nobody cares about your stuff. And it's not even my stuff. It's his story. But if you're, you know, if you're committing, nobody cares about it as much as you do.
Well, and this is not to make the publishers out to be a bad guy. Whether you're with a huge house or whether you're with a small press that has a lot of heart and believes in your story, or whether you're doing it yourself, the thing is, there is an awful lot of work that goes into bringing a book to life, and publishers just generally don't have the money to put into marketing your book, and sometimes more than marketing your book, distributing it and editing it and everything else, but especially from my perspective on the marketing piece, that's why you've got to take the reins and run with it, and that works regardless of how you're publishing.
I've found that the most problems is the breakdown of communication. The way that you said that the publishers aren't the bad guys, what happens is that you're not communicating to each other. You don't find out what the next step is. Several years ago, my mom helped me buy a house, and I learned that being a grown-up is just taking the next step, the initiative, the, okay, I need to get this done, so what's the next thing I have to do? And it's all a question of, okay, well, I've done this, now what? Okay, I figured out how to do this, okay, now what? And that's the difference between self-publishing, getting your own work done, being your own boss, being a grown-up, is just finding out what the next thing is, be it a webcomic, be it publishing. You go to the Barnes & Nobles and you open up the book and you say, okay, I'm going to copy this, I'm going to figure out what this is, and that really is how you do your own, you know, that's how you get anything done.
I started out with the idea that I wanted our book to look like, forgive me for saying this, but look like a real book. And after like a month and a half, I was like, you know what? This is a real book. I'm done. We're going to make it a real book. I don't know why I myself am dogging my own project by calling it like a real book. And after that, you just sort of have to, I'm sure you've seen this more than probably a lot of people, you sort of just have to be fearless. I'm going to call up and see what they say. What's the worst they can say? Like, quit bothering us. The worst they can do, which they did a lot of.
Well, I think one of the things with your decision on how to publish your book has to come, first of all, from why you're publishing your book, because there are a lot of reasons to publish. And not all of them end up being on the New York Times bestseller, and that's not a goal for every author. Some authors want to desperately tell a story, and they know they have a small niche market, but they want to reach that niche, and that niche may not be big enough to be on the New York Times bestseller, even for the best book. Some people are passionate about a cause, and they want to change the world, and they just want to get the information out there. Some people want the respect of a small subgroup of people who are passionate about a hobby, or a geographic area, or a family, and they want the respect of their peers. Just getting asked to speak about their book would be reward enough. And then other people, especially on the nonfiction side, self-publish because they want a back-of-the-room book, because they give a lot of speeches, they present to conferences, and at the end they want people to come back and buy a book off them and hopefully hire them for whatever their specialty is. Those are all valid reasons to write a book. They can be valid reasons to self-publish, but I think going, you know, your first step here with how to publish has to start with, why am I publishing? And that's going to guide you to make better decisions at every step along the publishing track.
And that definitely, having that drive, because you're going to get torn down and you're going to get rejected. You have to have a stack of rejections this tall before you get an acceptance letter. You definitely have to figure out how far you're willing to go and what kind of drive you have. That's talent can be learned. As long as you have the drive, you can get it done. I think in referring to what you said, Joss Whedon said, I would rather have 100 fans that loved my work than 1,000 fans that liked my work.
Unfortunately, I think he's a great guy, and I think his art is terrific. At the same time, that's easy for Joss Whedon to say.
I think the numbers might have been different.
Right. I'm sure 15 years ago, he might not have felt the same way. I genuinely think he's a great model for any piece of creativity or art or something. If you actually know it's worth your time and energy to put behind it, just like he did with Dr. Harville. Like, I want to do this, and I'm going to do this. And he, of course, had a little bit different level of time, energy, and commitment than a lot of people do who have to have a different job that pays them and that kind of thing. But it's the same thing. It's the same thing that any self-publisher does. It's the same thing that we did. One of the things that we learned, if you're going to treat your self-publishing like publishing, like we did, and form a publishing company, there's so many decisions that you don't even think that you need to make that you need to make. I'll give you one teeny tiny example. This book we estimated would be about 400 pages long. Mm-hmm. Came in at 486 pages long. That changes the size of the spool of paper they print your book on. And that's good for us because it got to be a bigger spool and that was less expensive. But that changed the facility in the country where they printed the book, which changed our ship time, which changed our publishing date, which changed our receiving date, and all of that other stuff. I'm a project manager. I was like, what? You're messing with way too many lines in my plan here. Like, I couldn't handle it. And so I said, like, is there any reason that we can't just use the little paper? And, they were kind of like, oh, dear, no. Just no. So you also have to have a little bit of humility to say, like, right, okay, sorry, I didn't understand. And the difference between the one spool and the bigger spool, 3,000 pounds. So me going, could we just use the smaller one? They're like, no.
It's amazing when you get that change of you're speaking different languages. The first time I printed a comic book, the printer went, oh my God, you have way too much tone on this paper. It's destroying the machines. And I was like, oh, what do you mean? And they said, well, look at all this tone. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And all this tone. I said, oh, you mean the blacks? That I filled in too much blacks. Oh, okay. I spotted too many blacks. And on the artist side, I was like, oh, well, I just spotted all those blacks. I can just cut some of that out in the page count. And the printers were using, oh, no, it's tone. And I was sitting, we were both saying the same thing. But we were going, I don't, you're speaking English, but I have no idea what you're saying.
Well, and I think what you said goes to another good point here on deciding how you want to publish your book from all the options that you have out there. And that is knowing yourself and being honest with yourself on just how many of these details you want to handle, you have time to handle, and that you know you are good at handling. That's a huge piece of this. You know, when you go with a small publisher or a traditional publisher, those issues like what press it goes on and who buys the paper and all of those issues happen in a black box. You don't know anything about it. You don't have to. You can go on and write the next book. When you are self-publishing, you have to get down into those details and you have to understand them and you have to make decisions based on them. So that's an aspect a lot of people don't think about until it's staring them in the face, is what are you personally good at? If it's only the creative piece, and I don't mean that as an only creative, but if you know you're not good at the production details or dogging something through and having that kind of project management skills, maybe you need to find a small press that'll take care of that for you.
Or even listen to, in our case, it's kind of interesting because I'll say it for the third time, it's not my product. It's not my, well, I guess it is my product. It's not my story. And we had to kind of settle in on this is your purview. This is your skill set. He's going to trust me to dog all those answers and everything else, just be relentless about understanding before I make a decision, which was a hard lesson learned. And then I'm going to let go of, This has to market this way because I don't know a lot about writing. I don't know a lot about the process of writing books or marketing books and that kind of thing. But that was a little bit tough in the beginning, I think.
Mm-hmm.
to sort of sort out. So my point is, if you're self-publishing and you are going it alone, there are people in your life who are saying, you know what I think? And when you feel like I need to make every decision, I have to have everything done, it has to work this way, maybe you're not listening to that person who's helping you with the pieces of your skill set that are a little weaker than others. Yeah. And there's always somebody out there who can do that for you.
And on the other hand, when you go with a traditional publisher, you know, one of the potential things to wrestle with is you're not going to see the cover until it's done. They don't ask you for your input on that until you're down the road a ways. Like it or hate it, this is the cover they got for you. You're not going to see the layout until it's done. You have absolutely nothing to do with the distribution. All of those mechanical decisions are made for you by the publisher, which is you're either going to consider as a really good thing or maybe not so cool thing. But that's part of the personality decision in to self-publish or not to self-publish. And Scott, I'm worried. You're not saying anything.
You guys are rocking it. I don't know. I'm in a stranger place with that one because I do have books coming out from the publisher and they do take care of all that stuff except the cover. I go to war for the cover. It's like I'm unfortunately got I brought an audience with me to the publishing deal because I give away all my books as a podcast and was able to build up a following there. So that was the one thing I fought on. They gave me a cover that had nothing to do with the story.
Well, I get to do I get to have input on my covers now, but
yeah,
I didn't on my first two.
Yeah, but there's definitely a trade-off. Because if you get a decent publishing deal and other people are taking care of all the stuff that we had to do for this, it's pretty sweet. There's a lot of really humongous advantages to that. And then the other side, having control over the granular detail of everything, being able to say, we pre-sold more than we thought, now we're going to put more money into the packaging, you know, we're going to add this feature, we're going to add this feature, we were able to do all of that. And we didn't have to ask anybody permission. We just had to crunch the numbers and say, can we get away with it? So I'm kind of living the dream right now because I've got, you know, there's the people who handle other things for me, and then I'm over here handling everything. And when I say everything, we spent 8 14-hour days in a storage facility that's the size of a one-car garage when our 5 pallets of books showed up. And I don't know if you've had this experience. That's
a
three. We're like, wow, 3,000 books is a lot of books.
Yeah.
You don't know how many books that is until they all show up and they're like,
when the publishers say, or the printers say, so where's your loading dock?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, it's a 2-car garage. And they said, okay, so you're going to need a backloader off of the Mack
truck you're
gonna
that's
coming
kit.
Down. Mm-hmm. Oh, and also telling them, no, I live in a suburbia. We have nowhere that a Mack truck can turn around.
Yeah.
I mean, little things like 3,000 mm-hmm. books.
Yeah. Well, and strangely, that's a fascinating thing because this book is, it doesn't seem so big, right? 6x9, 2 inches, 2.25 inches thick, whatever. 3,000 of these books? Oh, Lord. And we literally looked, like the first time we were both together and saw the 5 pallets of a box of 16, one box has 16, and I think there were a Google boxes, I'm not really sure. I'm done. It was a moment, if you can't tell, I'm a little chatty. It was one of the very few moments in my life. I just stood there like...
It was like, what the hell did we do?
What are we going to... And we actually have... There were 3,000 books. We have less than 1,000 left. We had done really well. We had done what we thought was the right thing for the long tail of the publishing of this book. There were going to be far fewer than left than we were going to send out. It's all sorted. Finding a place for 1,000 books was also a train wreck. It's a huge amount of actual physical space that someone else takes care of when you're printing with someone. It's one of those black box things, as you say, that you don't have to worry about, which is a very pragmatic manual labor thing to do, which we did on the hottest day of the year in San Francisco last week. Move 1,000 books in boxes to a place where they would be safe until you find people decide you need to read The Rookie.
Well, and one of the other things that is transparent when you're working with a traditional publisher and not so transparent when you're self-publishing is how are you going to distribute this book? Are you going to stand on a street corner and hand it out? Are you going to have a natural vehicle to sell these because you do a lot of speaking engagements, you do a lot of conferences as part of your day job, and so you're going to sell them from the back of the room, so you've got that built in? Are you going to give up every weekend of the year to attend 30 or 52 science fiction conventions and then pay for...
Yes, I did.
It sounds like fun until you're on about the 25th one. Okay? So there's a time on the distribution. Do you have the patience and the savvy to negotiate with a book distributor to get you into those bookstores? Are you going to go around all the indie bookstores and sell yourself? So getting from the garage into the bookstore is a huge process that still is a little stigmatized against self-published books. Be honest here. It is, or at least some people in the process are. So before you even get to be marketing the book, it's got to be out there because you can't market what people can't get.
Right, absolutely. And I think it's not just a small bias against self-publishing.
I was being tactful.
I know, and I have no tact, so I'm happy to do that for you.
Question about why did you choose to do a print run on that particular novel versus print on demand?
Okay, so he wants to know why did I do a print run on the book instead of just running a print on demand? There's a couple reasons. First reason is I already have an audience thanks to giving crap away online for 4 years and building up a lot of people, and assumed I could pre-sell somewhere between 750 and 1,250 copies the day it went on sale. So the model was I'm going to have the capital to produce this book, print this book, and ship this book before I ever have to spend a penny on doing any of those things. So that was kind of a little mini position of power that I was able to have. And the second part of that is the margins for print on demand, there's three parts. The margins for print on demand are not good. I mean, I would have, to make this book with, say, a Lulu Press or a BookSurge would have probably cost about $30 a unit, 35.
Yeah,
somewhere in that ballpark. Now, if it's already $37 it costs for me, and I want to make $2.50 and take it up to $39.95, that's exactly the same margin I'm getting from the big publisher now, when there's a reason the big publisher only gives you 10%, because it costs a lot for them to do all the stuff that they do. And then the third part of it was so that if we actually had the capital to do an offset run, and we had the audience to purchase the offset run, our cost per unit dropped dramatically down to maybe between 6 and 8. We haven't quite figured it all out yet. And then the third part of it is the quality. I mean, I'll just show you guys, like, we got the big glossy embossed cover. We were able to put in a 16-page full color insert inside, and all of this stuff to do these kind of things with a Lulu or a BookSurge is it would have been even more prohibitively expensive, and it would not have looked very good. They don't, as far as I you probably know more than I do, but from what I saw, they don't have the mechanisms in place for the kind of quality that I demand for the people who are going to give me their hard-earned money to buy my book. So those were the three reasons. I was able to pre-sell enough. I wanted to bring down the cost to make this an actual profitable business someday. And I wanted to make sure that people who buy my books to want to have them on their shelves for their entire life.
And Scott brings something up that's really important, which is that known audience for pre-sales. Most authors don't start to get that until the second, third, subsequent book. Now, some people come into publishing with that. If you're already a well-known speaker and you are already filling convention rooms as a keynote speaker with 500 people, your odds are pretty good that you've got a following that's going to buy your book sight unseen. If you're an expert in your field and people are already coming to you and you're getting media interviews, you probably have the following already. If you have been a major fandom person and everybody knows you because of your podcast, because of your fan involvement, and you can walk through a place like Dragon Con and everybody says hi and they actually know you, you probably have the following to pull that off. Most people don't start with that. So if you have that following, being able to say, hey, I'm going to be able to pre-sell my book before it's ever out and gain that working capital, really helps cover your costs. Otherwise, this is all out of pocket, and it's speculative, just like a silver mine in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say, if you have the kind of following or audiences that she's talking about, and you want to start crunching the numbers on whether you're going to do an offset run, by all means, do that math. If you don't and you want to use the book to start building your audience, then I think Lulu and BookSurge are fantastic.
Yeah, that is the biggest difference between the two. You have, if you've got a, you're just starting out, you have 100, you have a couple of hundred fans,
You put it on Lulu. You get $4 a book for each book that's sold. You don't have to deal with paying for the print run or the storage or anything like that. But if you have 1,000 readers or 2,000 readers, and you save up the $3,000 it's going to take to print your own book, you deal with all of that, but instead of making $4 a book, you're making $12 a book on the same book. So instead of making, after selling 1,000 books on Lulu, you'll make $4,000. Selling 1,000 books yourself, you're going to make $12,000. Which there's a couple more digits in there.
Well, let's qualify that just for a minute, because that's the difference between cover price and printing cost. But now, all of those tables you had to pay for in the vendor rooms of those 52 science fiction conventions technically come out of that profit margin. Yeah. Any ads you ran, any bookmarks you printed, anything you spent to tell people you have your book gets subtracted from that profit margin. So the reality doesn't end up sounding quite as good or have quite as many zeros.
Yeah.
And I also think one of the things that we found, I think Lulu is a good service, and I think that as you've enumerated, there are lots of really good reasons to do that. When you're in a position that you can, you want to make the investment, or you're in a position to take a different step, there are things, because Lulu has to be profitable themselves, you can't... It's a football story, if you don't know. The colors of the football team are orange and black, and we wanted the cover of the book to be black and these to be orange. Kraken's orange, but, you know. And we couldn't do that with anybody but an offset printer, where we could choose it ourselves, because they, of course, need to buy reams and reams of the end papers that match. So little things like that, when you're in a position to choose, also make a big difference.
I actually do sell... sorry, one more. I sell a calendar, and calendars don't sell very well, but I have a couple of people at Dragon Con who beg for them, because I do men in kilts with leaf blower, and a lot of the guys at Dragon Con are in the calendar because there's a lot of kilts here and I bring my leaf blower. it's a lot of fun. Oh yeah, sorry about that. And so I only want like 20 calendars. That's not worth going to a print shop. So I actually go to Lulu and I get 20 calendars printed up. I go for my graphic novels, I go to Canada and get 3,000 of them printed up. So that's the biggest difference.
Follow-up question. Since you pay for the print run, when those sell out, and you know they're going to sell out like that, do you do another print run, pay for it up front, store it, and go again?
For Dark Overlord, we actually put together a business plan that specified what we'd do before we began, because again, my skill set, project management, don't have the talent. So we did. We actually looked into what it would cost, and these are limited edition. We have each one will be numbered when Scott signs them, and they're sold. We have 3,000. Once they're gone, they're gone. We'll actually do. We decided to do another hardcover print run. Shockingly, instead of a trade paperback, moving to a trade paperback. But outside of the first edition, the first 3,000, you'll miss this 16-page color insert. That was for us. that was a way to make it a limited edition, to give the people who are really the reason that we have the capital to do what we want to do right a little bit of a benefit, but also to give the second print run people a really high quality product that we're proud of.
And we will continue to probably reprint the hardcovers, because it's a 7-book series, and the goal is we take pre-orders on NFL draft day every year, and then the book ships before the first week of the NFL season every year. Fritz free marketing. tie in with the people who are spending millions of dollars on marketing. At any rate, I'm plotting kind of an exponential growth in the audience of this, and so the next book, they may come in with the starter, which second book in the series, a lot of those people are going to want the hardcover available. So we will continue to put out smaller, like 3,000 copy print runs of this, unless things go nuts, and then we'll go from there.
She had a question in the back.
Well, let me follow up on one thing, because you said something that's music to my ears, which is we had a business plan for this book. Please write that down. Because if you intend to make money from your book, then you need to approach this as a business, not as art. If you have art or a hobby, then that's great. You can pour as much money down the sink as you want.
Right.
However, if you intend this to actually make you some money back, if you have a spouse that is expecting that you're not going to hawk the car, you know, if you have other people depending on you to get this money and maybe make a little bit in profit, you need a business plan. And part of that business plan is knowing exactly who your target audience is, so that you know how to market to them. knowing where they shop so that you can distribute it in the right places, which aren't always bookstores.
Knowing why you want to do this, like you said before.
Knowing why you want to do this, and when you're going to reach your definition of success, whether it's a dollar amount or an invitation from a certain place or winning a certain award. In other words, you need to have a roadmap before you get on the highway. And in the work I do with authors, helping them do their book marketing, that's often, unfortunately, they don't come to me until they have the book, and then we have to reverse engineer this. It's much better if you do this thinking up front, because you'll make better decisions from the packaging mm-hmm. to the distribution to the pricing. Is it going to be an e-book? Is it going to be a tangible book? Is it going? How's it going to be bound? Is it going to be an audio? All of those decisions happen around who's your audience, what do they want it for, and why are you doing this? So thank you for saying that. You need a business plan for your book.
Hang on a second. We had a question in the back.
Microphone's right there.
I've been fascinated about what you've been saying about building an audience, pre-selling your books, you using the podcast to develop an audience. Can you all speak a bit more about that marketing aspect and what role social networking may play in that, please?
Well, I mean, that's my whole career, is I got frustrated with my giant stack of rejection letters that I, you know, couldn't get my multi-genre books into a publisher, and I gave away a book called Earth Core starting in 2005. And just serialized. I record the audiobook myself. I give the whole thing away. And I've done several panels on podcasting novels, and I can have that conversation with anybody after. But the bottom line is a lot of people now are putting free content out online, and we are turning the power over to the audience to decide what the audience likes before the audience wants to spend their hard-earned money. So I feel like we are flipping the script, and I'm not holding people hostage anymore. Give me 25 books and 25 bucks, then maybe you'll decide whether you're a fan or not. I'm going to give you 4 or 5 full free novels and make you my servant. You know, basically, I'm like, that's how good my stuff is. I can give it away to you, and you'll still come buy things from me. And social media is a massive, massive part of that, because what's different now is it's you've still got your J.K. Rowlings and your Stephanie Meyers and your rock superstars, and those people are always going to lift out of everything. But there's another level below that, which is, you know, I can have my 3,000 Facebook friends and the 7,000 people with profiles on my website, and I can respond to a couple hundred emails a day. People are making actual, genuine connections with me. People are, you know, get on first name basis with me, and that's where the pre-sales, for me at least, that's where the pre-sales really come from. So social media is huge. I'm on Twitter all the time. I'm on Facebook. Not a big fan of MySpace, but I'm still there because a lot of my audience is there. And then set up my own website at scottsigler.com. That's a social media site. People come in with profiles and avatars, and they go crazy and you know, comments and forum posts and all kinds of stuff like that. It's not just important. If you don't do that, you will not be in business in 3 to 5 years in this space.
One of the other things that we did from a social media perspective, is we crowdsourced a little bit. The book is a sports book about space football, which, how do you say it? It's much better than I do.
It's Star Wars meets The Godfather meets Any Given Sunday.
Or,
I want to read that.
Yeah. Or space football. Both work. But we crowdsourced. We thought, okay, well, we're pre-selling, so do we fight the fight to get into every bookstore and then have, before the book comes out, also negotiate the terms of use with Scott's other publishing partner, Crown, or would people come out to a sports bar because it's a sports book during football season? Grab a couple of beers, have a burger, talk about the book. And we crowdsourced that. Went right out to Twitter and Facebook, and he went right out and said, you know, tell me what you think. What's the word? And people were like, bring it. Go here. If you're coming to my town, go here. And this is my favorite sports bar. I have my own chair. It has a plaque. They're very crazy for it. And so we kind of talked about it. I was like, yeah, that's where. And that's also a huge investment and of time and energy and money to do. And so tomorrow he's getting on the road and leaving on a 20-city book tour.
All totally self-funded. We're funding the tour through sales of the copies of the book. And the reason I'll have 50 to 60 people at each stop is because of social media, right, and the connections I have there.
Right, but that's how it all started. Yeah.
Well, and I think the other thing with that is to keep in mind that books do not have to sell through bookstores. In fact, one of the people who really pioneered this, Dan Pointer and Brian Judd both write extensively about non-bookstore sales. Dan Pointer, who has now written over 100 books and is kind of the self-publishing guru, that's P-O-Y-N-T-E-R. He has a great free newsletter. He wanted to write a book about parachuting because that was a passion for him, and he couldn't get anybody to publish it. So he said, what the hell, I'll publish it myself. Gee, I wonder where people who like to go parachuting like to hang out. Well, they're not in bookstores. I bet they go to sporting goods stores. He went sporting goods store and sold his book into the sporting goods stores, and it worked beautifully. So gift stores, comic book stores, specialty stores, new age stores, sporting goods stores, wherever your audience hangs out.
DragonCon.
DragonCon. Baby stores, you know, wherever they go, that's where they can buy your book. It doesn't have to be in a bookstore just because it's a book.
Yeah, I use the internet as that kind of, here, have this, you know, definitely mm-hmm. that, here, check it out, it's free, first hit's free. Mm-hmm. Now I have a store, and I actually, you know, give away 2,500 free comics, and then I said, okay, but I've written a book that you can't read online, that you have to pay me for. I don't think I would be working at some temp agency if it wasn't for the internet, because it is, I'm going to work for 2 years, you know, have a day job at a summer camp or, you know, working as a waitress, and then every night I'm going to draw a comic and give it away every single day for free. And it took 2 to 4 years, but after giving it away for free, then I had built up such a fan base that I went up to a publisher and I said, here's my book, and they said, well, this isn't going to sell. There is no target audience. It's not a superhero book. I have no. And I said, I have 20,000 readers every day. Where do I sign you up? And there is publishers that say, if you have a certain amount of readers, we will publish you, no matter what it is. And I do find that I can get my readers back. I can get more readers. I have a Ustream video that I do every once in a while that's just me geeking out over whatever. But people see it and they're like, wait, I identify with her. I freak out about the same things. I want to go to her website and see what she's doing. And I don't even talk about my webcomic in the Ustreams, but I still have people who are like, wait, I want to, you know, I'm like you. I want to know what you're doing. So they follow along with that. Networking. Do we want to follow blue shirt? Ears and then blue shirt.
Either way. I have a question about giving away free media. Do you have any thoughts or experiences on giving partial content away, like a few chapters or pages?
I don't believe in that. Personally, if you give me 3 chapters of your book, and well, why didn't you give me the rest of it? Why are you trying to trick me? That's just my general attitude. So everything I've given away has been the full, unabridged content of the book. And if I don't get you with the first, second, third, or the fourth, I have literally had people come up, and this will never happen with 3 sample chapters. I've had people come up to me at cons and say, I thought your first 3 podcast novels really sucked, but I really liked that 4th one. and where else in the world can you find an experience where someone is going to wade through 3 books of what they think is crap because it's free, and then you finally won them over by the 4th, and now they buy everything that I put out? You don't get that with sample chapters. So that, my opinion is, just if you're going to go, pardon the phrase, you're going to go balls deep, just give it all away.
Now, I'm going to come up with a little different take on that, again, because my fiction isn't self-published. My deal with my publisher did not include giving things away complete in their entirety for free. However, 2-3 chapters out there, I'm finding gets a lot of people hooked. Like you said, you know, first hit's free. And I've found that a lot of people have come back and said, hey, I read your chapters. I had to have the rest of it. I was hooked. I wanted to find out what was going on. And yes, it's out there pirated for free. So I guess if somebody really wants it, they can find it out on BitTorrent. I know it's out there, which theoretically shouldn't hurt sales.
It's good enough to steal.
It's good enough to steal.
Yeah. Okay. Piracy is free advertising.
And
if anybody knows how to get our book pirated into the Asian markets,
yes.
Please come talk
to
me.
We are desperate to get pirated in China, for God's sakes. Any of you guys print Chinese books in the side, come up and talk to me.
So Yeah, and since this is all recorded, of course, we are not, of course, endorsing copyright infringement or stealing in any way, shape, or form. However,
we're endorsing copyright infringement on Dark Overlord Media.
Yeah. Well, and there is a great book out there called The Pirate's Dilemma that deals exactly with issue. But I've had good luck with both putting out audio of the first 2-3 chapters. Audible is bringing my books out. They're fine with that. That's one of those trade-offs you make when you don't run the whole show is you can't just make those decisions unilaterally.
And there's one other thing. Sorry. There's one
I'm just saying, if you're doing it all on your own, you have control of it, I recommend giving it all away. As Jenny said, she says 2 to 4, I say it's a 3 to 5 year arc that you're looking for before you're going to make a penny at this. And if you know that going in, it should be okay. If you do cut a deal with your publisher, or you cut a publishing deal, and you do not have that audience, you're not going to have the juice to be able to say, I'm going to keep giving my stuff away. I was fortunate enough in mine, when I got my deal with Crown, there was a little bidding thing going on. And I told all the bidders, I'm like, I will give everything I write away for free for as long as I live. And if you don't like it, don't bid. So I was able to get that up front, but it was very much the Wild West then, and people didn't know that was even on the table, kind of, and I accidentally hit on it. So if you're doing it yourself, do whatever you want, but if you do cut the deal, try and talk them into it. But yeah, if you don't have the capacity to do that, and you can get them to give away 3 free chapters, that's better than not giving anything away at all, by far.
There's one other option there's another podcast novelist who's terrific, whose name is J.C. Hutchins, and he's doing an interesting thing with his book that comes out on October 9th. His publisher's not, I don't think, allowing him to do a serialized podcast of it, but he did an ancillary story using all the same characters that's coming out in association with it. So that's his, it belongs to him, he's podcasting that, it lives in the same world as the book that belongs to the publisher. So it's whetting your appetite, and I think that's a pretty smart idea as well.
It took...
Right, he's doing a lot of interactive media stuff.
Don't walk away with the microphone.
Scott.
Blue shirt first. It took me 2 to 3 years before I started getting a good fan base, and then it took me 6 years of drawing a comic strip every single day and giving it away before I could make a living at it. So look inside your soul and see what you're willing to do. I give everything away for free, and then for the sales stuff, I offer bonus material and extra information.
Yeah, and I'm going to say, I'm not able to give my full book away for free, but I, in addition to the 3 chapters and the free audios, I do a podcast that's free. I do a lot of other content out there. I do video blogs. I do blogging. So I give a lot of content away for free around my world. It's just not all of the chapters.
Yeah.
So the giving piece is huge and very important.
Blue shirt? In front, come back. You had a question earlier?
You.
Do you, sorry, the oh, blue shirt, short sleeves, he's looking behind him. There you go, now you're looking at me.
No, I didn't.
The gentleman in black did, though. Did
okay.
The gentleman in black right behind you, Scott.
No
more. All right, it's wide open. Here we go.
Okay, can you give us the pros and cons of finding your own distributor if you, you know, figure you want to get a limited print run of the book? What are the profit margins? Like, how much does that eat into it? And how effective are these distributing companies?
I'll make our side of that is real short. Number one, part of my deal with Crown, they said, well, you can publish that if you want to. If you can't have it in stores, that would be a good compromise for us, because they don't want people going to them and asking for a book that they don't have. So we don't have it in any stores. And the other reason we're sticking with that is we're just big believers in doing it all over the internet and actually mailing the copies. Getting stuff into stores, as I'm sure she will talk about in a second, is a gigantic pain in the ass. It cuts into your profit margins. You have to deal with returns. There's all these things that a two-person company, we can't handle. We're not going to handle it right now, so we're just, it's all internet. We don't have stores.
We did look, I did look into distribution, exactly what you're saying. So I'll get it to the point where I have 3,000 physical copies of a book for you. You get it out to my team. And the reality of it was the amount of money it would cost for them to do it without their heart in it to do it right and do it in 5 days, like your 8 days, like we did. We were supposed to do it in 5. And really kind of blood, sweat, tears method of doing it was insane. It was giving away profits we didn't know we were going to have, that we still don't know that we're going to have. And it's important. We talked about it because it was important to whether or not we were going to, you know, this is a big labor of love for the people who do give so much time and energy to Scott and his writing. But we weren't sure it was going to get done right, and we were basically spending all the money we didn't have on making sure it wasn't going to get done right. So we decided, yeah, we'll do it ourselves.
Yeah, when I had a publisher, Comic Books only has one distributor, Diamond, and you can also go on to Amazon, but. When I had a publisher, I had the prestige of I was in Diamond and I was on Amazon, and book two was actually in Barnes and Nobles and it was in bookstores, and everyone was saying, "Oh, well, you must be, you know, very famous and very successful for being in all of these bookstores." I never saw a dime. I never got paid for any of the books that were sold in Diamond or in Barnes and Nobles or in Australia or any of that, because the money had to go through so many different hands. The distributor takes 60% of the cover price. The publisher has to pay for the printing itself, which is usually about 10 to 20%. Then the people who worked on the book had to get paid as far as the editors. The guy who drove the truck to get the books to the docks that got it to Australia. So many people had to get paid for the work that it got into those bookstores. By the time it got down to the artist, I didn't get any money. So then the self-publishing of not being in bookstores and not having a distributor, if you're having it yourself on your website, yeah, you don't sell 3,000 books, you sell 300, but you get all of the profit from that.
We're in a different world now. In the time when these distributors were a critical part of the function, you had to have them in order to get your product and disseminate it out amongst your potential customers to sell. You don't need that anymore. If you do a free podcast, your potential audience in the U.S. is something like 150 million, and that's just U.S. English-speaking people, just like that. Billion people online across the world right now. So now you have the capacity to have instantaneous global distribution of any electronic content, and you are $4.95 package away from having your book in any customer in the U.S.'s hands in 2 days, and $10.95 away from having it anywhere in the world in about a week.
The publishing industry is a wonderful 19th century industry, and it's still functioning like that. And that's why there are umpteen middlemen, because it dates back to when you had to put crates on ships and sail them across the Atlantic. JC and I had a discussion about this when he was on my Ghost in the Machine author podcast. And my vision on how I think we're going to be, and I think publishing is going through a lot of what the recording industry has gone through with iTunes and Napster and all of that, with people saying, I don't want to pay $19 for an entire CD when I really only want two songs. You know, my vision is that we're going to see a lot more print on demand from even traditional publishers. They're experimenting with machines that are basically like Redbox for books, where they store thousands of titles, and then the time it takes you to to order a latte at Starbucks, you can tell it what book you want, and it drops out the bottom of the machine. Now, my vision on where we're going to be maybe 15, 20 years from now is that instead of a fax machine next to your computer, you have your own personal POD machine, and you go on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com, you pick from essentially every book that's ever been written, because nothing ever has to go out of stock, because nobody ever has to warehouse it anymore. And it drops out of your personal POD printer right next to your computer in the time it took you to go downstairs and get a cup of coffee.
The other thing to keep in mind is the world is changing in another way, too, in publishing, and that is the advent of the ebook and the advent of the smartphone. The smartphone, Kindles are wonderful devices. Does anybody here have a Kindle? How many people in here have a smartphone? Or how many people have a cell phone? Just maybe if you have a cell phone. See, this is, look around you, this is the future. So not wasting, unless you have an audience, don't waste time trying to find distributorship. Don't waste time trying to get in stores. Cultivate your online presence. Start to build an audience, because you're able to sell physical print copies online. And as we're moving into the more digital world, the majority of books are going to be read on electronic devices. And I know the print book will not go away. Our business model is we make these bad boys so tricked out that, yeah, I'm giving away the podcast for free, but if you want all the alien drawings and the team uniforms and the logos and the 26-page timeline and the 50 pages of extra content, you got to buy the book. So it's a treasured keepsake. I think that model will continue, but don't worry about I don't worry about it, just do it all online, because in another 3 or 4 years, that's what's going to be going
on
anyway.
Finding out what you want. That's don't jump to the ring saying, oh, well, I want to be a success. My version of success is being in Barnes & Nobles. Well, people in Barnes & Nobles aren't making nearly as much money as the people who are just selling it out of their garage online to people in Australia. Nowadays I can say I'm a world-renowned comic book artist when nobody at Marvel or DC knows who the hell I am, because I'm still selling stuff to England and overseas online. There was a lady that had a... There was somebody who had a question.
I'll say one other thing while we're looking for the next question. One of the other things that's fascinating to me as a fan as well is the amount of interaction that we've been able to have with the audience for this book. For example, Scott's not going to be back in San Francisco until October because of this book tour. So the personalization of the books that people buy from his website, I'm able to send them, or Scott's able to send them an email and say, hey, I've got options for you. I'm happy to send you a signed numbered book by Wednesday when I get home from, or Friday when I get home from here. If you'd like it personalized, you're going to have to wait until October. Sorry about that. We should have been more clear. And without exception, the 30-some-odd books we've sold since we've been here at DragonCon online, people are like, I'm happy to wait. Thanks for letting me know. You know, and they're happy because because it's a personal product and it's a personal investment for them, it's a little bit different. They're coming to find us, not like wandering around saying, what's going to entertain me?
And one common sense thing about distributors that Jenny touched on, just want to make sure I clarify, if you are dealing with a distributor, you will not see your money for a long time, if at all. And we have actual credit card machine with us, and we had a party yesterday for this book. We had 22 people buy books. It immediately went from the customer's account to our account, just like that. Done. There's no middleman. We have the money today. So that's something else to keep in mind instead of wasting your time with distribution.
Well, which was also able to, or allowed us to be able to make like Rockstar Tour t-shirts with all the numbers, the dates on the back.
He's got one in the back. Stand up, show off the shirt.
Killer. Yeah. Turn around, Mitch.
And that's all the cities we're going to right there. So good times.
But that was because we had the immediate the funds to be able to do that immediately, and we were like, okay, well, that's more product people might really like. Let's do that.
Well, and I'm seeing a lot of nonfiction books done as e-books, sold or given away right off the website, and especially for people who are doing a book to enhance their professional reputation, to bring in more clients, if that's what your goal for doing the book is, then having a nice professionally done e-book that you can give away, that you can follow up when you meet people at a conference and say, by the way, here's a link to my ebook. Hope you download it and enjoy it, is a great way to get them to call you back and say, hey, I loved your ebook. You know what you're talking about. Now I want to hire you to handle my account. So, again, it goes back to what you want out of your book, but that's definitely part of the model in the nonfiction side.
There's a question in the back.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could provide some more thoughts as far as marketing plan and developing a customer base, whether you want to focus regional, local, just the fan base on the internet, wherever people show up.
Your market is the world. Your market is the English-speaking world because of the internet, unless you can either have someone translate or you speak another language. So as far as physical appearances, anytime you can go out and meet people who are interested in books and your stories, you should do that, because every time you meet someone and shake their hand, you are building a potential customer for life. But I wouldn't worry about regionalities. It's the world is your oyster.
And that was how I started out of online, was the world, and then once I had enough fans that I knew if I went to a convention then they'd show up, or once I knew that I had enough product that I could go to a convention, then I tried to do something in my area so I didn't have to pay for hotel and travel and all that. So then you start off local and you try to hit your local bookstores or your local comic shops, or you know, start off in your area, and that way you can kind of get a feel for how people are going to react to it, what your pitch is, and you start learning as you go, going to the conventions and trying to hand out the cards. Having something that people can walk away with is a huge thing. Having a little sampler of your work, having your work on a website where you can meet a publisher, meet another artist, meet a potential reader, and hand them something to say, here, check this out when you get home, when you go away. And also, you know, being personable. I think it's a balance of the information you provide, your work, and also the way you provide it. You say something snide to one person, and everyone says, "Oh yeah, I like their work," but God, they're a horrible person. And
yeah,
you know, they said that you know, Scott Kurtz thing.
And keep in mind, as you start to do this, your market is your world. Your market is the world. You are the brand. Mm-hmm. If there's anybody out there who's going to say, "I don't like the concept of an author as a brand," it's you. You're branding your name, because even if you have the one book you're pimping out hardcore right now, that book's got a life cycle. You move on to second, third book. You are branding yourself as not your universe, not your world. You're branding you. And then everybody will associate everything else with you. And as you go out and start to do these personal events, being a nice guy or being a nice girl are, like, that's the friggin' bottom line. Because if you're a dink, who wants to spend their money on you?
Well, and I think going back to your question about the regionality, in my experience, most authors think too small instead of too big. Because, you know, for example, suppose you wrote a book of ghost stories on historic Atlanta ghost stories, and you think, well, only people in Atlanta or only people in Georgia are going to care about that. No, probably every Gone with the Wind reader would pick up a copy of Historic Atlanta Ghosts, and you've got a potential market at every ghost convention or paranormal convention. You've probably also got a potential audience at Civil War reenactment events. So, you know, a lot of people think too literally in this little box around their book, and because it's set in a certain location or a certain time period, they think, oh, these are going to be the only people who are interested. Think bigger than that and think of where those people congregate. And so I agree, your market is the world.
One other thing I'll say, and actually each one of you touched on this, and I'll go back to saying it is important to have a business plan if you want to make this a business, but there is art to it. I mean, and you three as artists, one of the things that you have in the world as your space is ancillary information about you. You all have different podcasts, or not just content, not just you have different ways to see that you are a real life person, which I think in the virtual world replaces the ability to walk into a bookstore or walk into your marketplace or walk into a face-to-face reading and get all that sort of crowd noise from the rest of the room. This is what it looks like. This is how he interacts with the people in the front row. This is how your books look on the shelf. The thing that replaces that is all that non-content media that's out in the world around your books. That's you and not the content, and you and not the book. I think that for me as a fan, that's a very important thing to see. It's harder for me to identify with a writer whose work I love, but I don't really know what they look like, or they don't have I hate to say this, but they don't have a really nice website that's accessible. It doesn't even have to be super fancy. It just has to be accessible, and I need to be able to see a picture of them, and I want to know what their cat looks like and stuff like that.
John Scalzi's made an entire career of taping bacon to his cat.
He sure did. Exactly right.
That's how things got rolling for him, and he's a massive online presence and a strong writer.
It's amazing where something will take you, because I started the webcomic as a way to just draw every day while I got the real job, and now the webcomic is my real job. So keep an open mind.
So, question for you. Since merchandise now is part of the whole thing, it's not just books, out of curiosity, what percentage comes from merch, like what I'm wearing right now?
Well, seeing as that's pretty much the first entry in the catalog right there. It's a football book, so we've geeked out. We have NFL quality jerseys in the team colors, and we've got t-shirts and things like that. We got a Kraken's jersey, we got another Kraken's t-shirt back there. The junkies are coming up and representing. So we're experimenting with that, because we have that t-shirt, the gray t-shirts, first when we actually went out to a printer and they sent us all the t-shirts, and we have them in large boxes that weigh a lot. And other ones we've done print on demand, but for merch. So we're able to upload images, and we have actual human beings we're working with who make sure everything looks okay. And then when people buy them, they print them and they ship them. But percentage wise, I don't know.
It depends on what we're doing. In this case, it's a much better thing. It's a much higher margin, like the hardcover is. But everyone in this room, I'm sure, has had experience with Zazzle or Cafe Press or something like that. And that's very akin to Lulu and Book Search, that there's a terrific benefit to having that, especially, actually, the gentleman in the back of the room in the Kraken's t-shirt. It made his a unique to him fan shirt, which is killer. but of course, you can't. There has to be a way for that company to make money too, just like Lulu. So it depends on the benefit. We would make very little money, if any, on a cafe press kind of thing. There's also a question of the quality of the product, which you need to be concerned about. But in the case of the t-shirt you're wearing, we had a lot more control over it. And for us, it was important that it be a real person doing a real thing and taking a look at it.
And I think merchandising, as you touched on, has a higher profit margin than
for
books.
Sure.
Just about everything does. And, you know, the quintessential story there is about how George Lucas forewent his pay for Star Wars, but I think he made it up on the merchandising. and that merchandising, you mentioned calendars. There are, even in the nonfiction side, whether it's calendars or journals or coaching cards or CDs or DVDs, there are all kind of ways to repackage the information and resell it in a very usable, customer-friendly way that's got a higher margin than the book.
Yeah.
It goes back to what you want to do, because I've actually, a lot of different webcomics make their income in different ways. I've chosen to do merchandise. I've chosen because I adore putting my logo on hand sanitizer and wooden nickels and kilt-blowing calendars. And I have a deck of playing cards that's men in kilts with leaf blower playing cards that has nothing to do with my webcomic, but it was something that I wanted to do, and it sells well. Other webcomics decided to make most of their income from advertisements or original art sales or just donations, member donations. None of that is something that I was interested in figuring out how to do. I'm not technical enough to figure out advertising. I'm not technical enough to figure out the donation or organized enough to keep track of who made donations for membership. I just want to put my name on everything.
Yes, ma'am?
I had a question about kind of one of those old school barter system sort of things. Like, my fiance designs websites, and it's one of those, is it something, would it be beneficial in social networking to say, okay, you know, you get somebody little unknown illustrator or someone to do your website, something like that, who won't charge a lot because they're hoping to get benefit off of, you know, their logos at the bottom of your website, and it's advertising, it's free advertising for them, it's free for you know, if they can give you a discount on a really good site that will show a picture of your cat,
yes,
you know, whatever.
Yeah. Well, in my case,
absolutely, yes.
In my case, it is my job. That's exactly how it started. Scott and I met in the social media space, and then I actually think, did we meet here last year in person? And then that led to me doing a little bit of work. I own a company that's an event planning company, doing a little bit of work for him that gave us a chance to get. And all of that work was simply because I was a believer in his work, and he was a good guy, and it was valuable to me as a potential source. And now it's my business. So, yeah, absolutely, it's essential.
Yeah, now realize that there's a risk side on that, too, because you may back some people who don't turn out to be superstars, and well, you know, there you are. But sure, I mean, you know, the story I've heard is that the guys who started Nike hired somebody to do their swoosh for them for about $75. Well, you know, now that they probably had to scrape up lunch money to get it at the time, but that person now can say, I designed the Nike swoosh, and nobody's paying them $75 anymore.
Any other questions?
Approach them and say, hey, you know, I'm not sure if you can hear me. Do you ever run the risk of when you do approach somebody and you know, through that social networking, how would the best way be to approach somebody and say,
you just come out and say, I want to do this.
Mine.
I want you to do this. I think this would be your benefit long term, but it's also possible you'll get absolutely no benefit out of it all.
Yeah.
And you just say that, and if they're offended, fuck them.
There is one other thing. I do think that everyone, and this more than me, these guys can probably talk very clearly about the thing you are is, I mean, you are your brand no matter what particular story that you're doing. I really believe that's true, just like Scott said. But also, that's your whole, you know, your whole coin. That's everything you do. So you have to protect that. So it's worth, if like in my case, you know, here's my skill set. If I can help you out, let me know. And he approached me to say, hey, can you help me do this one thing? I'm going away for, you know, I'm doing this week-long event. I need your assistance. If I had blown that, he would have to suffer the consequences, and I seriously hope never, ever, ever work with me again. So that's the risk to you for asking, is you also need to have a high-quality product, and you need to deliver. And if that's not the case, you need to understand that in a professional sense, these guys have to protect the one thing that they have, which means kind of, there's no harm in asking, there's no harm in being told no, because that's going to happen too. But there's also, you have to bring it. And you have to understand that if it's not quite working, they have to protect their brand, I think, because they only have this one shot. You ruin it one, as you said, you know, you're rude at a con to one person who has a loud voice, it's all over. And it, you know, if you kind of let one piece of your big marketing machine fall by the wayside, and people start noticing that as part of your brand, that damages your brand.
Sure. And I think, you know, the people who are probably going to be most receptive to that barter situation are going to be people who are just starting out. Well, they're dark horses. You're not going to know which ones are going to really make it, where people who are more established probably have people in place, or they may be more squeamish about working with somebody who approaches them. So that's the risk and reward trade-off again.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, if you come to me, can you blurb for my book? I might be a famous author in 4 to 7 years. I mean, that gets evaluated at one priority. But if George Lucas shows up and goes, one of you do this little bottom script work and you won't even get a credit line, you know, it's things like that. You evaluate as you go. But the people who are hungry to succeed are looking for opportunities to show what they can do. And the smart people also know that even if it doesn't benefit you now, it can come back in 2 or 3 years if you develop those strong relationships. And when someone comes to you and says, oh, God, I'm dying to find a web guy, you're like, I know just the guy. As a matter of fact, he helped me with my website 3 years ago. So all that, I think the internet's made the barter economy very much,
absolutely,
it's brought it back,
yeah,
from wherever it went, but it's alive and well. The vast majority of the work I do on my website, the graphics that gentleman in the back is wearing, that was just one of my fans who's an artist who says, can I do some logos for the book? Absolutely, you can do some logos for the book. Let's see what you've got. And now this book,
yeah,
is full of all of the logos that he did, because he just crushed it. He's sending me logos. I'm like, that's awesome. And I got my first tattoo on one of my fans, and
who's
it's his logo.
DragonCon, yeah.
And it's like, I just got to see it yesterday. So the guy, the artist who did all this for free, is just absolutely giddy. You know, he's like a star on my website. People are getting tattoos of his art. He could not be happier. So it works.
Yeah, I love that tattoo thing, because I have a symbol for the goddess in my book, and a friend of mine bartered it with me. Mm-hmm. She's a good friend of mine, and now it's. One guy emailed me and said, can I get the symbol of the lady on my right arm? I need something to counterbalance the dark mark on my left. I said, yeah, you go for it.
Yeah.
But it was mentioned the level of your personal goal, and whether or not your personal goal is to become famous, and your definition. And I think that everyone has a different definition of famous. Mookie has a T-shirt that says, I'm famous on the internet. Because at this convention, my friends turned to me and said, Jenny, you're famous, because we get in an elevator and somebody says, oh, you're Jenny. And I keep turning to them going, yes, yes, but we go anywhere else and nobody knows. And that is the first time somebody tattoos your work on their body, is both an incredible and terrifying feeling. I did a commission with the guy. He said, I want to get a tattoo. I want your angel and devil doing a tug of war. And we went back and forth with artwork. And I kept sending him, saying, well, do you like this work or this work? And he said, oh, I'll take this one. I was like, but this one's better. and it was something that he loved. And I saw it. And I was like, wow, the skirt really should have been down lower. But it's what he wanted. And yeah, I think that's, you have a point in that it's all worth it. 6 years of doing a cartoon every single day for free and working my butt off and having the day job, and I got an email from my childhood idol. The reason that I am the woman I am today is because of Tamora Pierce and Alana, and I got an email from Tamora Pierce saying, oh, I really like that cartoon you did where you're reading that book of the page. And I was sitting, the 5-year-old in me was going, it's Alana, she reads my stuff. Now there's no pressure for doing the cartoon.
Can I ask you guys, do any of you have tattoos of your own work?
Not yet.
It's a fascinating thing. So
I don't
there's
think
some
my work is good enough.
I faint really easily with needles, so it just isn't a good idea.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what it would be like to have somebody else with your creation forever. Yeah, you need to. You people need to step
up. It's not like a back or a shoulder or something. No, yeah, he looks at that
both.
Every single day.
Yeah, but the people awesome. Who asked me for it wanted it for the forearm.
God.
Do you have any advice about the advantages or disadvantages of literary agents? You know, how tough it is to get unsolicited work in?
The only story I have for an agent, I interned at White Wolf, and they do the gaming books and incredible artwork, which was a bizarre experience for me because my art wasn't nearly as good as those books, and my job as an intern was to throw away all the application packages while I was printing off my application package for Dragon Con, going, I'm just printing trash, I'm just... But they had an artist that they loved, but his agent was such a pain to work with that they said, well, we really want this guy to work, to draw for us, but we don't want to deal with his agent because we think it's annoying. And so the guy actually lost work because his agent was just not...
I'm going to come in on the other side of that. I have a fiction agent and a nonfiction agent, and I love them both because they make money for me and I make money for them. And they earn their pay when they negotiate a contract in my favor. They earn their pay when they look through a predatory contract, predatory in my opinion, because when somebody with a lot of clout and big lawyers tries to put extra clauses in there to squeeze, you know, blood money out of a writer, I think it's predatory, and those are the stock contracts out there. When they go through and go, no, we're not doing this, or no, you need this percentage, not that percentage, that's when they earn their pay, and, you know, that's not what I went to school for. So they allow me to get paid more fairly for what I do. They see pitfalls that allow me to keep more ownership of my work. And they have the personal connection. A good agent has personal connections in the business where they can call up those people that you see on publishing panels. They have lunch with them every Tuesday. And they get your work in front of them instead of just being another unknown name coming through the slush pile. So I have had a good experience with agents, and I don't mind paying them their commission at all.
I agree. Having the right agent is critical. I had an agent for 9 years who was an awesome guy and really worked his tail off to try and make something happen and built me up this nice stack of rejection letters. But after 9 years, I felt I had to try something different, and the next agent I had me in an auction at 3 of the 5 biggest houses inside of 6 months. So, I mean, it's just because he had lunch with the kind of people who would like my kind of book, whereas the other guy had lunch with the people at Tor and other places that didn't quite get what I was going for. Now, had I done a space opera, I'm pretty sure he would have sold the crap out of it. So you want an agent, but that's another one of those time-consuming processes is the agent hunt. And how things have changed since I started doing this 15 years ago, I wouldn't spend any time on it at all right now. If you're going to be giving away your content online and spend the next few years developing an audience. Because if you bring an audience, if your cover letter to an agent or you meet an agent at a conference, hi, I'm Scott, I'm an author, my work is similar to your other client because you have to research these guys, and I have 10,000 people reading my comic every week, can we talk? You're going to get that meeting. If you don't have that, you're not. So the process of getting an agent is just like the old school process of sending blind submissions out to publishing houses. I think it's a waste of time. You're better spent building product, building an audience, making connections with your online to your audience, and then you get them. But the flip side of that is if anybody comes to you with the lawyer team, and anything with the word Sony in it shows up and happens to be interested in what you do, you say, I will get back to you immediately, and then you go find an agent. You don't want to deal with these cats.
You may be able to snag a publisher without an agent, but you better not sign a contract without an agent.
Yes. And that's if any of you are lucky enough in that regard, your roommate from your sophomore year happens to now be the purchasing agent at Tor and knows your book and wants it, that's great. But if you go to the agent of your choice and say, I have an offer on the table from Tor, can we talk? You'll get that meeting very quickly too. So they're running a business, and if somebody can show up like free money, they're perfectly happy, and then you evaluate whether you like them or not.
Just make sure your agent is an AAR signatory. No upfront reading fees, no nickel and diming. Make sure that they're legit. And I'm a big big proponent of the Writer's Digest Guide to Literary Agents. Find one that handles what you do. Make sure they're AAR.
And also do a search for the agent's name and the word editors and predators.
Make sure they're not on Writers Beware.
It doesn't take a lot of research to see if an agent is valid, but a little bit is really important. And again, if anybody, any agent asks you for money, that's
run.
Run.
Always sleep on something. I've had too many experiences where they always sound too good to be true. Somebody comes to me with a contract, or they come to me with an idea, and they want to do something, and it'll sound perfect, and it'll sound like a win-win situation. How can I go wrong? And I'll sleep on it, and I'll run it by my friends and my mom and whoever's sitting next to me. I say, hey, this guy came to me, and they want to do an Oxygen live-action TV show about my webcomic. And then somebody says, well, hold on, I looked at the first two paragraphs of the contract, and they say if they make a movie out of it, you get $10,000, and that's it. And that's, you know, if any lawyer or anybody looks at that, they're going to fall off their chair laughing. And so definitely run it by. And so when I came back to the company and went, you know, I don't think I'm comfortable with this, and I don't know if I can write for this. And they said, oh, no, you don't have to write it. Just sign at the dotted line. We'll have somebody else write the TV show for you about your autobiographical strip. And I went, oh, I got to go. I got it. You know, there's a thing. I got it. So if it sounds too good to be true, sleep on it, walk away, look over the contract. I had a couple of publishers come to me, and I was like, wow, I love your, you know, I turned to them and said, I love your stuff. I'd love to work with you. Let me look over the contract. Even if it's Santa Claus coming to you, you smile and say, thank you, that's awesome. Let me see the contract. I'm going to go home and sleep on it and have my lawyers look over it.
I'll add one more thing. Even if they're people you've worked with before, it's worth reviewing. This is why I'm bringing it up.
Okay.
Yeah.
My first publisher, who we both started out, I'm a no-name author. She's a no-name publisher. We put out a couple books, and things are starting to cook for both of us. That person got bought out and brought in a new company, and then they sent me like, oh, we have movie interest in your book. I'm like, great, who is it? They're like, well, you know, we don't want to say because if we got the deal, it's fair that we get compensated for it. I'm like, fair enough. And they send me the contract, and this is before I signed the contract with Crown/Random House. In this contract, this is a person I'd worked with for like 3 years, wanted 50% of the adaptation rights for not, and it wasn't just for the movie, it was for everything. So it was for video games, graphic novels, any cartoon and comic books. This is someone I had worked with, for 3 years, and that's their stock contract, as she mentioned. And they had, and I'm like, I'm reading this, like, I don't know, this is really all that cool. Do people really get paid half the money if this is made in a movie? They're like, well, everybody else has signed it, and their other 15 authors had signed it, and that's when I took it to the new agent, and they were just like, and they couldn't believe that it was even in there. So yeah, so. Any contract, you've got to have other people reviewing it. But, I mean, back to your original point, until you have an audience, you got people coming after you, maybe it's not the best use of your time trying to find an agent.
Yeah, and just the other caveat in there is there are so many details on the publishing piece, again, because back to what we were talking about before, about how royalties are accounted and reserve against return, which is we're not going to give you all of your advance because we think bookstores might send a percentage of the books back. So I think we'll keep, 80% for 3 years. Is that fair? That happens. That shows up in contracts. So an agent is paid to find those things, know what the language actually means, know what it means to your pocketbook, and then watch out for both of you, because a real agent doesn't get paid unless you get paid.
All right, we're going to have to wrap it up now, but thank you very much.